Here with Coach Strobas from University of Arkansas, in charge of track and field. And for those that don't know, not everybody knows track and field, but the equivalent of UCLA during John Wooden's era of basketball, Nick Saban, Alabama, probably more national championships than anyone in the history of track and field. If I'm not mistaken, John McDonald is the more championships than either of those two coaches I mentioned combined. Upwards of 20, if I remember. I read a biography on him, which was a really long biography, but big fan of, obviously, Arkansas track and field, SEC track and field. So, Coach Strobas, we appreciate your time, and we're excited to have you on. And you've been there a year, is that right?
Yeah, so I just crossed over 1 year. I got hired on last beginning of the fall. First day on the job was September 24th, 2024. And here we are. Today's October 21st, 25. So.
Also, and have you learned the Pick Suey call or chant?
Yep. Was that Yeah, it's the whoop Pick Suey. It's, you know, you do it, you raise your fingers, you twiddle, and you whoop Pick Suey. What's funny is working track and field, anytime you go to an SEC or an NCAA championship, you're going to hear it. So I kind of knew it already. And, you know, when I wasn't working at this school, I hated it. But, yeah, it's something I look forward to any opportunity that I get. And my wife actually is getting it figured out. So, yeah, we love it.
It is. Yeah, it's I guess if you hear it in the track, then it's probably an indicator that something good happens. So you want to hear it a bunch during a meet. Sports science, which is something, again, we're Division III, probably looks a little different. The goal is, how can we help our interns at this level? And it might be technology we don't have access to, but we always like to at least touch on the topic and what we can learn and or do better at our level from experience that someone like yourself has. So on that, I segue to Brock Calvillo, our intern, to kind of cover some sports science topics.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
So first question to get started, what kind of got you into getting your bachelor's in sports science? Because I know a lot of people go into like the exercise or like more the PT side of this bachelor stuff. So what kind of motivated you towards sports science instead?
Yeah. So, I mean, cut and dry, the straightforward answer is that, you know, where I did my undergrad, Washington State University, their kinesiology, KHP, any type of that degree boils down to being a bachelor's in sports science. So anybody that went through that program came out with the sports science. Now the approach that they take is a very, you know, exercise physiology, biomechanics. We even had like a sociology of exercise and classes like that. But that was kind of what got me into it. I think the approach that they took was really, really good in just having an all-encompassing kind of approach and understanding of physical activity and exercise and things like that. You know, if it says anything, our capstone course that you had to take in order to finish the program and so on and so forth, other than an internship, was exercise prescription for medical conditions. So it was very much a all-encompassing kind of approach to, you know, what is the physiology of a medical condition? What's activity and exercise they can do? How does it affect the person from a psychological or sociology perspective? And it was just really all-encompassing. And, you know, I've done sports science, I've done strength conditioning, I've done sport and exercise psychology now. But I think that base level approach of sports science from a ground level is what got me into this, but it helped push me in a direction of you can do a lot with just that first kind of ground level understanding.
That's good. And then with track and field, you know, it's a lot of times, you know, you like got a PR every week, something like that. What type of like BBTs or tracking systems are you using to monitor that?
Yeah,
so how often do you do that?
What's actually interesting, and it might just be a me thing, but we really don't use anything here on a regular basis at Arkansas Track and Field. We have access to tendo units, valve force decks. We have biomechanics labs that we use, and we have things like the 1080 sprint. We have a lot of technology, but from a day-to-day, we don't really use anything consistently. For me, my approach with the performance of our track and field athletes is I want their main focus and their main kind of reinforcement to be how they're feeling on the track and at practice. So a lot of the time that, I guess, monitoring or measurement comes from what are they doing at practice? You know, what is their times like in the runs that they have? What are they looking like on the 1080 sprint when they get hooked up to that, again, in practice? So day to day, there's not really something that we use a lot. We'll go through phases in the weight room where we'll rely on the Tendo units every single day, but that's probably a 4-week block going in between our seasons, you know, indoor to outdoor, so on and so forth, that we can measure that, have them have the idea of what's fast, what's slow, and why, and then we go on from that. So not to burst the bubble a little bit, but not a huge thing. And we'll use force decks. We're very big on measuring absolute force output, obviously imbalances, and then elastic response with our athletes. Track and field is very, very reliant on the dynamic strength index, or I believe that's what it is. And that's, you know, how elastic versus how strong an athlete is. And you'll see very different ratios of elastic versus pure strength athletes come in, especially in just a men's sprinter. But things like force decks, VBT, we use Tendo units. Those help us monitor, measure, and sometimes just identify what an athlete is like.
Do you guys have like a sports science staff that is getting all this data and giving it to you, or are you a part of that to where you're able to look at it and be like, okay, this is what they look like in that 4-week block. What do we need to do to get better at that? Or is that kind of just like a back burner thing just to have just to show?
It is me that does it, that compiles a lot of the data and will send it off to our coaches. I have a pretty rich history of doing that, both here at the University of Arkansas during my 6 years at the University of Kentucky, and then even when I was doing my internship undergrad at Washington State. I am kind of a techie nerd kind of person, so it is a little easier for me to just have it done in-house, and maybe it's not the exact perfect situation, but I can give them the information, the answers, or whatever data is that they need, represent it, whether it's, you know, numbers, graphs, bar, whatever it is, and then go from there. And now we do have a sports science department here at Arkansas, but a lot of the things that we'll do, you know, when we use the Tendos or when we use the force decks, it's very accessible for me to just go in and kind of make the reports or represent the data. So I do it almost always.
It's an interesting point because you don't measure in the weight room per se, but I would think, are you at the practices? Because they're probably talking velocity loss threshold or drop offs. Hey, once you drop off this much, we're cutting you off. You're not doing speed training anymore. And there's no need for GPS because it's predetermined the amount of distance they'll cover.
Yeah.
So deceleration. So it's a different animal in a lot of regards. But I guess once they step on the track, like you said, what you're really looking for metrics wise is, hey, are they hitting their times? Are they feeling good? Are they hitting their marks? Whatever the event is, are you out there at practice? Are you having conversations with the coaches of like, hey, this guy's, you know, we don't have a GPS, we don't need one, but man, his times drop considerably. What's going on with them?
Yeah, and you know, it's as simple as, and yes, I'm at practice. Whether it's, you know, I record film for the teams or the event groups. I'm taking times and tracking things like if they have a workout that's time specific or distance specific. I think, you know, a very layman's terms way to explain it is we can take a video, a side view of one of our athletes coming up out of the blocks, hitting their acceleration phase and then continuing on through the race. And we can quite literally just see, do they look more elastic in their stride? How fast did they stand up? How stiff was their body coming out of the blocks? We can just see that, right? We can just kind of take the eye test to it. And there are ways to test that, again, with the 1080 or, you know, motion capture or things like that. But if we need to see it just quickly and, again, represent it to the athlete in the moment, we can see it very well with film. But we do have those as well where we can hook them up to different sensors and get that data, hard numbers.
And also, you mentioned you have your background in psychology, so you got your master's in. Is that something that has helped you grow as a coach, like being, especially in track and field, that's a lot of, you know, it's not much of a team sport. It's kind of just you versus you. Like you're just trying to beat a time. Is that something that's helped you, you know, kind of relay the message to those athletes or?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I've always thought about this is that the master's degree, especially in strength conditioning, this might be a controversial opinion, but is very much like a token, right? You get your GA, you go and do 2 years or 3 years of experience, and that's your golden ticket to say, hey, I can get a full-time job now, right? Because you've done 2 to 3 years at a school or whatever it is. That's awesome, right? But for me, you know, I had the opportunity to get my master's degree, and I knew that whether it was sports psychology or just the mental health aspect that we all are aware of when it comes to student athletes, especially at the higher levels or any level, really, I was like, this is something that having a deeper understanding is going to make me a better coach, bar none, like regardless of what sport I worked with. And so for me, it was like kind of a no-brainer. Let's go. Let's do the psychology. No different than, you know, if I was somebody that really wanted to take a sports science route, be someone that had the opportunity to, if I ever wanted to step away from strength conditioning, work into the sports science realm, the high performance sector, things like that, then I would want to get my master's degree in exercise physiology or biomechanics. But for me, I'm a coach, right? So getting that background, having that understanding and experience just made me a better coach no matter what sport I was working with.
Because you mentioned that you are at the practices with them. So is it a lot of like, hey, we've noticed, we took film on you, this is what you're going through, or this looked off, is there something going on, like you're not feeling right, or is there something else that we can help you with? Or
yeah, I mean, exactly. I wouldn't say it's giving me the eye, because I think any of us, when we work with our athletes, we can tell if maybe they seem a little off, or maybe they're in a mood, or something's bothering them if they're dragging or going through the motions. But having that background and a lot of the classes that I took during that master's program was counseling techniques, sports counseling, helping techniques, basically more so than not, you know, therapy sciences, right? How to have conversations that help people, whether it be in the moment or just to gather information and kind of give a better picture of what they're going through. And whether that be my conversations with the athlete or me reporting back to our medical staff or our coaches or whatever it is, it just allows me to gather information and have a different eye for those things, right? Is it something physical? Is it something mental, emotional, social? There's so many different things that can affect our student athletes, no matter what. They're people, you know? So more than anything, it just helps me have that, I guess, foundation and background to see those things, but then be able to do something with it as well.
Sports science, but might be more track and field, but I'm thinking relays. Double points, obviously a priority. And do you ever time baton exchanges, or does that happen where you're timing the efficiency, or maybe if you need to change legs, do you put a sensor on a baton to see how fast it passes through the zone, or do you film it with a drone how do you work relays? Is there anything you use? Kind of don't give away any secrets, but I always we put a free lap. We athletic tape the free lap chip to a baton and wants to see, you know, how fast it was going through the zone. And I found it interesting. I didn't do it long enough to determine anything from it. What do y'all do in terms of relay exchanges?
Yeah, so we focus more so on the technique of it, right? And if we get film, then we'll go through and maybe time the splits of the handoff or anything. But especially in the 4x1, the handoffs are probably the most important thing. You can have four fast guys, but if they can't get the stick to each other, it doesn't matter. So a lot of the time we focus not only on the timing of it, but in the exchange zone, how far in, how far out, what is the technique, and what's the matchups with it? You know, if we have our fastest guy on the anchor and we have our third fastest guy on the third leg, what is that exchange going to look like if we flip that around? So really, we just kind of take that approach to it so that we're efficient and that we're technically sound. And a lot of the times the splits just take care of themselves when it comes to the exchanges.
Great information. Yeah. And the pre-lab athletic tape, it was an experiment. It didn't work. It flew off sometimes, especially if you drop the baton, which that was your first indicator it wasn't going to be a good relay. You got bigger issues if the baton goes on the ground. let's move from sports science because you didn't burst servo, but yeah, there wasn't, wasn't a lot, but it was great information. Kind of intern professional questions. We'll start. We'll just go around the horn. Start with Blake. Fire away.
What's up, guys? So I'm currently studying for my CSCS. So I was wondering if you had any test prep, you know, that you thought was really useful when you were studying.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to put this out there speaking absolutes, but my 100% success rate study, I guess, form, so to speak, is find some sort of, you know, app or Quizlet or something that'll let you take practice exams. If you find a good one, it should be able to, when you take it, it'll give you the feedback of what you got wrong and what you got right. For me, when I took it back in 2019, it was Pocket Prep CSCS. That might still be a thing, which was not only an app on the phone, but there was a website. From there, take the quiz, right? And then when you get your feedback, you know, you got this question wrong, this question wrong. When I did it, it would give you a citation from the NSCA book. What I would do then, I would go to the NSCA book. I'd go straight to that page, take a big sticky note, write down the question, write down what the answers were, circle what I thought it was, stick that in the page of where that information is, and then highlight why the right answer is right. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So yes, for me, and I did that every day for an entire summer, mostly because it's kind of fun, honestly, but also because what it did for me was it leapfrogged the information, because there's so much information. There's no secret to that, right? But it leapfrogged what I already knew and got me to the things I didn't know or maybe that I struggled with a little bit more efficiently, so that I got more practice and I spent more time just focusing in on those things, honing in on that information, so that there wasn't cracks in my base of knowledge, essentially. Right. You know, everybody has their own inclinations. You might be really good at the sports science or the nutritional aspect. I might be good at the psychological factors part of the CSCS. But this helped me get just a complete filled in picture to then go into the test feeling confident that maybe I'll get tricked on a question. But if it's a pretty sound, pretty good question, this is what I think the answer is. And, you know, again, I had the information from the book. So if it was wrong, man, was I going to cause an uproar. But from there, just continued onward and just figured out what the questions were, what the answers were, why I thought they were the right answer, and then why they were the right answer or wrong answer, so to speak.
I don't know why we've never asked that question, and that might be worth anyone else out there listening. Chris, mark that. We need to put that as part of our post. That everyone needs to hear that because everyone has to take that.
Yeah.
It's good stuff there. Ashley?
I have two questions, actually. First one is, how much did the classroom work help you versus hands-on experience? Like, was there a major difference and you learned everything you need to know just hands-on, or did classroom help you a little bit?
I would say, I hate to say it depends. That's my least favorite answer, but it depended on the class, so to speak, right? At Washington State, we were super lucky that we had a strength conditioning minor program. So not only did we have classes that were focused on plyometrics, advanced strength training, programming, but we also had the internship that coincided with that. And those blended really well together. Coach Lang, who was the director of strength conditioning, also taught one of those classes. So what was, you know, the conversations I'd have in the weight room with him, I'd be having in the classroom with him as well. And that really, really helped. Now, other courses like exercise physiology, maybe not immediate impact in terms of what am I doing on my day-to-day in the weight room, especially during an internship where my job is to give some coaching cues, clean up the weight room, make sure things look good, and learn as much as I can. But further now into my career, when I'm on my own writing workouts, having legitimate conversations on what to do and when with upwards of Olympic athletes, that base of knowledge is where that's really coming to handy. So it was kind of experience was extremely important up front, but the classroom came back around to being important after the fact.
And then what does an average day look like for you?
Oh boy. Okay. So an average day for me is it's not that bad, actually. So I'm very lucky here at University of Arkansas that this position just works with track and field. So while that is a lot of athletes, a lot of coaches, it's a pretty organized and straightforward day. Today, especially at 8 a.m., we had our men's sprint group. They came in, they lifted for about 45 minutes. Then for the rest of the morning, I've done admin work, programmed. You know, we've got our pro groups that are starting up pretty soon. So I've really kind of hunkered down and gotten their annual plan sorted out. I'll do whatever I need to handle, maybe work out and then, you know, meet with my trainers or my coaches. And then about 2 o'clock, that's when practices will start. I'll be at practice. And then exclusive to our men's program, they will actually come back after practice and do another lift. It's technically the same lift. We just split it in half, but all of their accessory based work, and we can chat about this later, just X's and O's of strength conditioning, we do on the back end of practice rather than before. So that'll get done around 3:30, 4 o'clock. And then depending on the day, I might have a group in at 4:30 or 5:15. And then after that, done for the day. So it is a little bit of a long day just because there's this massive gap in the middle. But when I was at University of Kentucky and I had track and field, cross country, men's tennis, women's tennis, cheerleading, my day was jam packed, back to back to back lifts. And I loved it. But now having less athletes, more admin work has kind of filled the day, but it's just depending on the position really more than anything.
That's, and we can, like, so I'm curious, the sprint crew, 8 o'clock lift, and then that's coordinated with what they're doing on the track at one or in the afternoon. So you, mm-hmm. when you're programming, which we'll get to the nuts and bolts, but what point you talk programming, you didn't do it probably as an intern. You probably didn't do it as a GA. When was the first time you sat down and you're like, this is me, this is all me, and I'm writing this program, and success or failure is me? I mean, did you have that opportunity as an intern or GA, or was it not until later?
Well, I mean, I had a very interesting time at the University of Kentucky. So I was there for roughly 6 years. My last year there would have been my full 6 year. So I say 6 years, but I was there from 2019 to 2024. And in my second year as an intern going into, I got there in summer of 2019. In the December of 2021, my main position was the assistant, you know, intern, not graduate assistant, because they didn't have that position, with track and field. And at the time, the head track and field strength coach just left the business entirely. Didn't want to be a strength coach anymore. There's nothing wrong with it, but just left. And with very little notice, I was given the entire track and field program at the University of Kentucky. And that was, again, that was my second year being an intern. And so very quickly, I got that realization of, oh my God, this is me. But I had been prepared for it with my position. I'd already kind of started the GA route at the University of Kentucky. And so I knew that me having my own teams would be coming eventually. I just didn't think it was a track program. It was going to be cheerleading or tennis or something like that. So it happened fast, but I was prepared for it, I think, is the big thing.
And I guess is that how you got into track and field world? You're just driving on the highway and all of a sudden you avoided a car, exited it because the guy left, and now you're a track and field guy? Is that
yeah.
it?
Yeah, I will say, because everyone always asks, like, oh, like, what events did you do or anything like that? I didn't do track and field, nor did I do collegiate sports. I'm just a strength conditioning nerd, and by the grace of God, track and field just lines up perfectly like Legos when it comes to my brain in the weight room. My entire 4 years of internship at Washington State, I was with track and field. They had lift groups all throughout the day, you know, morning, afternoon, whatever. And I tried to be in there as much as possible, so I was with track all 4 years, basically. And then going from there, when I went to Kentucky and they were picking teams for us to work with, I got put with track and field because I had 4 years of track and field experience, or at least exposure. And then 2 years into that, all of a sudden I'm a head strength coach for track and field. I'm still an intern, you know, I'm not even anything like that, but very much I fell into track and field is the way that I word it. And even, you know, during my like finishing up my graduate degree at Kentucky, I was very much like I was in the tennis realm of things. I had really good relationships with my coaches, different people around the professional and collegiate world. And so I was like, I am going to be a tennis strength coach in college. And then my track and field career in terms of coaching just continued to grow, continued to blossom. And now here we are. So.
Yeah. And it's probably like the mafia. Once you're in, it's hard to get out if you're a track and field.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I had done a, I'll say it for myself. I don't want to brag. I've done a pretty good job at Kentucky in terms of helping our athletes succeed, keeping them healthy, and having a little bit of success post-collegiately on the circuit in terms of working with athletes that had moved on to the pro level. When this job opened up, they called me. And so it was very much a situation of, okay, like, not only can I not say no, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity, but for me to continue growing my career, if I wanted to take a step in any way, there wasn't very many other steps that would be better than this. So I knew that track and field was going to be something I was doing for the long haul, but I always thought that I would be, you know, track and tennis, track and soccer, something of that capacity, just because schools tend to pair things up like that. So being able to just focus in on track and field for probably the rest of my life, honestly, but for my career is wonderful because it lets me do as much as I can for them. And again, learn as much as I can from them as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. And there's obviously the commitment to track and field at the University of Arkansas has. You're not doing cheer tennis. This is the thing to do. This is what we're known for. Kyrie, what do you have?
So during your time, like bachelor's, graduate, whatever you want to call it, you might have ran into some mistakes. I'm not sure if you did or not, but if you did, what were the mistakes and what did you learn from them and how did they help you out or anything?
Yeah. So, and this actually goes back to when we were talking about my degree. I was a terrible student. Like, I will tell anybody that. I'm not really shy about it. I graduated Washington State University with a 2.7. Like, it was really bad.
It's not that bad. It's really not.
That bad, right? Like, I can still play football in the SEC, but I'm not playing football in the SEC. So it was very much an eye-opening thing. One of the classes that I didn't necessarily take that serious was a class that I needed to pass, and pass means get a C or higher. And I had already lined up my internship at the University of Kentucky. I had accepted it. I was going to leave 3 days after graduation and move down there. And I almost didn't pass that class. And so it was a very aggressive, eye-opening moment of, for me, especially the back half of my college career, I thought experience was everything. You know, yes, I'm not doing that great in school, but I'm getting so much time in the weight room and I'm working with all these athletes and I'm getting this experience. I almost didn't get to go and do anything with it, you know? So especially during undergrad and grad school as well, because that motivation to do as much as I could in order to keep growing translated to, hey, you need to make sure you take care of all of the things. And now working with collegiate athletes who are also students, I expect the same thing out of them just because I can tell them that exact story and hopefully they can get set straight as well, because they can't compete if they don't do well in school. So.
And then, hey, Chris, side note, mark that. We'll send it to Stillen, and we'll have Kaiser keep that and watch that throughout the semester. That's great advice. And your GPA was about online with mine in the 1900s when I graduated from here. You had to have a 2.75 to get a teaching certificate, and I retook 12 hours to get my 2.75. So I can empathize with you. Brock, you got any? I know you did sports science. You got any intern kind of?
Say you're going for an interview. What are some things that we should be prepared for as like coming? Like, you just interned, you're looking for either a GA position, or if you're a GA and looking for that assistant strength and conditioning spot, what's some things that's going to separate you compared to someone else?
Yeah.
Is it got a little more experience, stuff like that?
Yeah. I think more than anything, especially in this world where it's very competitive to get those positions, whatever you have that can set you apart, whether it be hey, yes, I can do all of this work with my sports science technology, but I can also do a great job with Microsoft Teams or Power BI and represent it. Whatever you have in your skill set that is going to bring something to that staff, whether you know that they don't have it or whether you're going to help enhance it, that is what needs to be at the forefront of your conversations. It sounds grim, but every person that comes out that gets, you know, applies for a position, they're going to have weight room experience. They're going to have swept the weight room, folded towels. They're going to have observed lifting. How many people got the opportunity to run valve force decks, take the report, advise programming based off of it, and et cetera, right? That's something specific for you with sports science. But more than anything, again, what are your skill sets? How does it set you apart? But make sure it's your real skill set, something that's unique about you. And maybe even that's your public speaking ability, right? Maybe it's the fact that you know multiple languages. Maybe it's the fact that you can do graphic design, social media. I'll tell you first and foremost, when I got the internship at UK, when I got the paid position, the biggest thing that I brought to the staff was my background in graphic design, social media, video production, media, everything like that. Like, yes, I was a strength coach, but they were getting someone that could do social media, do content, and help promote the staff in the University of Kentucky that they didn't have before. And that was huge for them, but it was also huge for me to kind of put that as, hey, you're not just getting another strength coach, another body, you're getting this as well.
That's good advice as well. And then hopefully the good thing about Division III is we get a little experience in everything. And
yeah,
multiple
yeah.
sports. It's different, but it's a good opportunity to get your experience in a lot of different areas besides just cleaning. Like you said, everybody gets that. What are you going to do to stand out? And if you get good enough, that you don't technically interview. They say, don't mess this up. The job's yours. And just, you know, here's some answers you want to give the president of the university. You meet with them. Nuts and bolts, track and field, strength and conditioning, probably no better relationship. The two of them go hand in hand. Boyd Epley started NSCA, measuring things. But like any marriage, sometimes there's stress and there's lack of communication. You ask some strength coaches, you say the word track and field, and they cringe because there's usually some animosity because track and field coaches, they want to train their own athletes in the weight room, and the strength coach becomes just a facilitator. How do you go about that? I know, is it meeting with coaches? Is it sitting down together and planning? What does that look like? Because y'all do it better than anybody. And what could someone that struggles and goes, I hate the track and field, I don't want to work with them. What can we do? I'm not saying that's the situation here. I'm just saying what could be done better at a school relationship-wise?
Yeah, I think, you know, when it comes to being the strength conditioning coach for a school, you are, quote, the expert, right? You were hired in, you were brought in to do the role of programming and coaching and implementing things in the weight room. But that doesn't mean that nobody else on staff knows anything, right? I made a point when I took over track and field at the University of Kentucky to constantly be talking to our head coach, Lonnie Green, about what does it mean to program for a sprinter? What is it that you're expecting out of your team specifically? What are things that wasn't present in the program that can be brought in? And you know, a lot of the times the ego will tell you that you're just being a pushover, right? But at the end of the day, your job as a collegiate strength conditioning coach is to help these athletes be in a better position physically to perform for the coach or for the program or whatever it is, right? So a lot of the time it comes down to having just the conversations about the sport with your coaches, right? You, meaning any strength coach, have this wealth of a background in biomechanics, exercise physiology, squats, you know, whatever it might be. And putting them into the context of whatever sport it is, whether it be tennis, track and field, just sprinting, just jumping, basketball, swimming, right? The coaches have the wealth of experience in those sports. And so working together and finding that common ground of, hey, what do you think about this? Or, hey, how important is this to you? And whatever those things are can be event specific, team specific, programs, you know, whatever it is, you know, even like, you know, seniors don't need to focus on the same thing as freshmen. Right. And that's just conversations with the coaches or anything like that. So for me, I make a really, really big point to constantly be talking with my coaches, conversating with them about how does the weight room look? What are you seeing? Are you seeing something that we're missing? So on and so forth. So that I can make sure that not only what I think of what does a complete program look like for a track and field athlete, but I have so much more input as well. And I think that's something a lot of strength coaches miss in the standpoint of, you know, they're given a team, they get hired in for a job, and they go gung ho in implementing their style and their movements and their training. When at the end of the day, yes, you were the one that was brought in, but it's the coaches and the athletes and the school's program that needs to perform. So that unique kind of, I guess, perspective on it when you're starting with the team is huge. Because for me, you know, I'm 28, right? I've only been doing this for 10 years now. I started at 18 as an intern, a freshman in college, and now I'm 28. So I'm literally 10 years into this. But I work with coaches that have been doing track and field for 30, 40, 50 years, right? I would be remiss to not ask them their opinion or their thought or to gain knowledge from them in some capacity. So I take every opportunity that I can.
Good answer. And y'all have a healthy marriage. It works really well. And I don't, in my opinion, track and field, you couldn't do other sports because instead of meeting with the basketball coach, the baseball coach, the cheer coach, you're meeting with the sprint coach, the jump coach, the hip, the DECA. Those are head coaches of their events. If I was to look on your desk and see your programs, how many different ones do you have? For those, I mean, I guess sprinters, jumpers.
Yeah. Men. Yeah. So on the men's side of things, actually on both sides of things, I've got the long sprints, which is, you know, your 800 to 1500 guys or girls. I've got the short sprints and hurdles. I've got the horizontal and vertical jumpers. Currently, they're on the same program because it's the off season. They tend to split out in season. So that can be either one or two programs. We have our multis program, our distance program, and then depending on if the school has it or not, there's usually some throwers in there as well. Here at Arkansas, we don't have any throwers, but when I was at University of Kentucky, I'd have that as well. That's just for one team, right? Here at Arkansas, we're a little unique is that our programs are separate. We have a men's track and field and we have a women's track and field. It's not co-ed. And so my six programs I just listed off for you, that's just for the men's team. Women's side, it's sprints, short sprints, long distance, jumpers, multis. And it's, again, it's the exact same thing, but every year that changes. So it's never the same thing.
You work with both men and women, right?
Yes. Yep.
But they don't coordinate and technically practice together. They're their own separate entity.
Yep. Yep. Uh-huh. Separate coaching staffs, which presents a unique opportunity just because that does cut the amount of coaches you can have in half, so to speak. But also on that standpoint, separate budgets, separate director of operations and schedules. They go to different meets, practice at different times, lift at different times. The only thing that they share is, you know, the facility as a whole, just because both locker rooms are in here, and then myself and our sports medicine staff. That's the only real crossover they have.
How do you... You have all these different programs, and I've watched some of your videos on social, and how do you do plyometric speed training, that being part of their sport itself or their event coach? You're doing a lot of bios in there. Is that a shared responsibility, or how do you program that?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the coaches. You know, getting here and talking with the coaches, how much plyos do they do from a regular standpoint? And also, for the young strength coaches listening to this, just understanding, okay, what are we talking about when we say plyos? Are we saying box jump? Because that's not a plyometric. That's a jump, right? We're talking about quick ground contact time. You know, are they getting that out of their sprint training? Are they doing dedicated hops and skips and things like that? or are they not getting it at all in practice? Because then we need to do it in the weight room. So that's really the biggest thing, is having the conversation of what each coach does, maybe day to day, week to week, so that I know, okay, in the women's sprints program, they do a lot more volume on the track, so I'm not going to put as much jumping and landing because that's just more impact on their bones. The men's team, a little bit more minimal effective dose, higher intensity, lower volume. They do a lot more of the skipping and the hopping and the plyometrics because not only, A, do they not get as much in training, but it's also they can take a little bit more of it just because their volume is so much lower, right? So with that being said, it's just a conversation with the coaches. What do their volumes look like depending? And then when it comes to speed training, plyos, jumps, all of those things, they could be doing it at practice or they could be doing it in the weight room. For me, more than anything, I make sure the weight room is about training the characteristics, right? You don't see us doing a lot of sprint drills or running action or leg action or starts in the weight room, but you do see us putting a lot of emphasis on ground contact time, posture, knee drive in terms of height and mobility, arm swing, postural muscles. That's all still running, right? That's the same terminology and vocabulary that they get from the coaches during their skill sessions, but we're putting it in the weight room and making sure that it connects, not only for the athletes so that they know that they're getting the best training they can, but so that everything is relevant to what they need to get better at.
And then does that also involve tapering, beating, or are you transitioning off season now? So maybe you're doing a band assisted jump or a repetitive broad jump. And then when you hit the indoor season, do those things, the volume decrease?
Yep. Yep. So one thing that I do is, because track and field season is so long, I mean, we go January for cross country, we go August to June, which is so long. For the indoor and outdoor season, for the track and field specific athletes, January to June, and that's a long time. So I plan out a very large macro cycle. Most of the time, it's the entire year. And I put in little notes of when we're going to do an assisted jump versus resisted or body weight, maybe the amount of jumping that we're going to do. And I have that when I go into my conversations with the coaches, just so I have some sort of skeleton that I can make adjustments off of or keep in plan if things sound like we're all good and we're in a good spot. With that in mind, every team is different, or every event is different, right? Again, same idea with having multiple programs, different coaches taper and change things throughout the year at different rates. So that's where that annual plan, that kind of skeleton, is huge, because it allows us to visualize what we have, but then know where we can make edits from, because you're going to make changes, but it's having a structure to mold and manipulate rather than just saying like, all right, we're doing three sets of 12 pogo hops. Like, it's just being intentional with structuring and scheduling out.
And for, again, I could be wrong, but for young coaches, I think weight room is probably the easiest, because everybody's lifted weights at some point in their lives, so they feel confident in programming for that. I think it's the speed and plyometrics that they don't think about until they're like, hey, you're about to write this program.
Yeah, yeah.
It's harder to, like, are you periodizing off number of contacts, off of distance travel, off complexity or intensity? Is it a jump or is it a plyometric? And I guess specifically, let's say, for example, it's today, if you knew they were going on the track that afternoon and you knew exactly what they're doing, did you jump sprinters in the weight room this morning? Because you wouldn't do it post after they ran, would you?
Yeah, no, there's really nothing that they'd gain out of that, except maybe working on a little bit more technique, right? But from a physiological standpoint, they've already got a massive base of fatigue from practice up on their bodies. So yeah, we wouldn't really do it before, but for me, I try and keep it as simple as I possibly can. I keep things in reference in terms of, you know, volume, how many reps that we're doing. But a lot of the time it just comes down to when they're doing these series or sets of jumping, how is their body going to feel? And then I usually have that be my guidance of when I pick what throughout the year. With that being said, we usually will start the year doing band assisted work because it limits the impact, right? It pulls some of their body weight off of the impact. then we'll go to either body weight or resisted, depending on the group or their experience with it. And then we actually do band assisted work in season. Limits the impact, but also works on the speed and the elasticity of their stretch shortening cycle. So it's really just, how are they going to feel when they're doing this? And honestly, band assisted jumps are a ton of fun. So a lot of the time I save that for in season as well, just because I want my athletes to have fun in lifts and then go run fast as well.
Yeah. Olympic lifts. I've never known a track and field coach who didn't use them. Seen great technique and implementation in your videos. In the world of transfer portal, in the world of foreign athletes, in the world of track and field, freshmen, what do you do, or what's your teaching progression for someone that looks at you and said, I've never done a clean, I've never done a snatch? What's your kind of starting point with those athletes?
Yeah. So regardless of transfer, freshman, tons of lifting experience, no lifting experience, our first 4 weeks, maybe even 5 to 6 weeks, depending on the group or the time of the year in terms of 20-hour, 8-hour women's team, men's team, we do an orientation process. And even my returners will go through that process. And that is from the ground up, this is your start position for a hang clean. This is your start position for a power clean. This is how you lower into that position. This is how you transition to the pull. This is what the start of the third pull looks like, getting into the catch. And it's very step by step by step by step. The returners tend to hate it because they're like, coach, I know how to do this. But for me, it's revisiting technique before we start loading them up, you know, as we get deeper into the off season. But it's also a ton of volume work, right? Like bar none, they're getting a ton of volume work in because they're just getting reps and reps and reps of technique, but it's still reps. So it's very much checking off that first initial block of keeping things very low intensity, maybe a little bit higher volume. And then for the newbies, right, if they've never done anything or if they're just a transfer, great, they get to learn technique. And especially this is where I love having returners, is they can watch and observe somebody that knows what they're doing on top of them doing it. And it's just a very big like learning emphasis on that. So that's how we do it. It's
are you
been
doing it on command? Are you
yes?
Are,
yeah.
On the whistle, or like, hey, feet hip width, you know, bar right on top of your shoelaces, whistle, and they're going, so you can see them all go at the same time.
Yep. Yeah, and I'll give a shout out to the staff at Kentucky that really brought me up in terms of that thought process. Is yes, it's on command. It's everybody all at the same time, mostly so I, as the coach, can watch everyone, but also so that there's an element of like patience, right? A lot of them tend to rush through the learning process that first block. And so it's a really big learning lesson when I go, okay, top of the knee, and then we go to the top of the knee, the hang clean start position, and I see someone stand up early. No, now we're all going to stand there and hold it until either you get back down or until we're all reset. And usually the group tends to auto-regulate in terms of not letting people come up early or anything like that. But yeah, on command and really working on form and technique and positions and just taking the time to do it, because especially the track kids, you know, we start in August, they're not going to run until January. So we have the time.
Slow cook them for sure. A question on resisted sprints with the caveat, don't talk to me about 1080 because that would be 5 years of our budget. If you didn't have 1080, what are your thoughts, feelings, resisted sprints, yay, nay, phase out as the season gets closer, or resistance in front of you, resistance behind you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No 1080, because at some point you probably didn't have those.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we didn't have them at the University of Kentucky. And so, you know, sleds are an awesome thing to do. Or if you have a strap and you have a vest or just a strap, cool, attach a plate behind you. I think the resisted sprints, depending on the weight, are a great way to work and reinforce technique or positions without having to hit full speed or having to go all out, right? That for me, when we use tools like resisted sprints, assisted work, at the end of the day, it's just working on an isolated part of their technique. And so a lot of the time when we do resisted work, it's the first 20 meters of their race, right? Their start, because we can watch them lean away, right? Lean forward if it's a resisted sprint, so that they can continue to pull it. But that's also them working on that forward attack lean, right? In terms of coming into the blocks. So we're really for it, but we do keep it simple. Like, our men's team doesn't use a 1080 at all. We just use sleds. And, you know, we'll push a sled with a prowler, or we'll pull sleds. Kind of depends on the weight that we're trying to use. But, yeah, I mean, that's what we would use absolutely. So
I find it – and I cookie cut or shotgun approach. I understand percentage of body weight, but at the end of the day, you got a 45 on each – side of the prowler. Is that kind of how y'all do it as well, or do y'all?
Yeah, it's, again, we're just trying to kind of reinforce phases or positions. So if we need to go lighter or heavier, it's a little bit of a you know, calibrating process, maybe the first or second time that we'll do it in a practice. But yeah, we're just kind of monitoring what weight they get into a good position. Not that their rep needs to look really good, but we're getting out of it what we need to, whether that be lighter or heavier. So.
And then last nuts and bolts question, which, again, you can tell maybe I'm biased on the track and field, but they were probably ahead of everybody in terms of recovery. If anyone had a Normatec sleeve on, it would have been track and field way, way before other sports. That's always been part of their training. What do y'all do in terms of recovery at Arkansas?
Yeah. So we're very lucky. Back in 21, we built a new outdoor facility that houses not only our weight room, but our state-of-the-art training room. And then on top of that, our lounge, our locker room, everything is right here, one-stop shop. Our training room, they've got access to pretty much anything that they would need in terms of treatments, or, you know, the feel-good stuff like Normatec boots, the hot tub, the cold tub. One thing that we don't do a lot here at Arkansas is we don't ice. And that can be for various different reasons. But for us, you know, we want that inflammation process to continue on. And that's what's going to help them recover and get healthy. And sure, it's not going to feel great, but better for a long-term benefit in order to that. So it's not that we consciously say, hey, don't ice. But a lot of the time we promote different recovery habits and just the timing of them, right? For us, we're very big on just, you know, get your recovery in. Go be in the ice tub, or go be in the hot tub. Go get some rest. And then when you're back at it, when you're back ready to go, we're going to rehab. And we're going to rehab hard. And that's my approach in the weight room. That's our trainer's approach. But it's helped us stay relatively healthy, because we're not falling into the gaps where we're missing those things. So recovery-wise, we promote the basics, you know, Normatec boots, good rest. A lot of the time we do a lot of dry needling here at Arkansas. It's a really easy and efficient way for our two trainers to work on somebody, maybe get some needles in them, and then they can manage a lot more people all at the same time, rather than having to be on top of somebody, you know, doing an active release or whatever it is. So that's a huge thing that we do. I'm pretty sure all the trainers here have that. But other than that, we keep it real straightforward, real simple. We're big on sleep. We're big on sleep and making sure that the kids have the education and the access to the nutritional aspect of it. And a lot of the time it takes care of itself beyond that. So
do y'all have a training table that takes care of it? And then do you have a massage therapist or chiropractor that comes out and works with your athletes?
So we'll have two massage therapists that will come to campus. I believe on Wednesdays is our day that we do it. And they'll, just because track and field is so big, they'll be here most all day. And we schedule kids in for 15 to 20 minute slots to get whatever it is that they need. And then once a week, we'll bring a chiropractor in, usually for just some adjustments or, you know, some chiropractic related stuff. But a lot of the times our trainers, which is Jess Price and Molly Mattson, they take care of everything. They're rock stars, and we're really lucky to have them. But if they can't handle something, then we figure out where we can bring somebody in or send someone to whatever.
How many athletes do y'all have combined, men and women?
I believe this year, you know, the SEC did impose the roster limits, and then the NCAA had them as well. I want to say that we are at 79 or 81, somewhere in that ballpark. We're going to add quite a few from what I'm hearing at semester, just, you know, kids that are international and maybe had to finish primary school or something like that. So we should be around 85 to 90 at the time of, you know, when the school year finishes. But we kind of falter between 75 to 90.
And that's without throwers?
That's without throwers, yes.
I was just curious, because I love throwing more than any event. What was the decision there to not have throwers, and how does that impact? There's points you're leaving on the table at every conference meet.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a tough situation, and, you know, I'm not part of the scholarship or any of those kind of conversations, but I can imagine, you know, are you going to give a full, you know, we only have so many scholarships to give out. Every school does, right? And are you going to give a scholarship to a kid that can score in one event, right? Maybe get the 10 points, maybe go and win the event, right? Let's say shot put. Or are you going to go and get a really, really good 200 runner that can run the 100, the 200, the 400, maybe be on the 4x1, maybe the 4x4. Like, it's just, you know, it's a game of numbers kind of at that point. And so it's mostly that is the logic. On our men's side, we do have decathletes. Part of the decathlon is throwing, and also so is the heptathlon. But dedicated throwers, we just don't tend to bring them in, not because we don't see their value, but it's just a numbers game at that point.
You've done good with that. So
yeah.
They're not scratching their head going, how can we get throwers in here? Mm-hmm. We'll wrap up with some rapid-fire questions. Book recommendation. What book maybe you read now, you're like, man, this book was one of the best I've ever read?
Yeah. One of my like go-to books, more so on the sports psychology route, is a book by Trevor Moad. It's actually, my laptop is sitting on top of it right now. It's called It Takes What It Takes. It's about a sports psychology kind of mindset. It's a little bit of more memoir-esque. But there's a lot of really good information there in terms of taking the experience or the story or whatever it is, and how he worked with an athlete, and applying that into your own life or someone else's. Another book is called Peak, which is by Dr. Mark Bubbs. With that one, more than anything, that book is an all-inclusive sports science, recovery, sleep, nutrition, strength training. It's only about 400 pages. But its goal is to represent or give the most up-to-date kind of good information on these things. For me, more than anything, though, I went into it and I was critical, right? So I read those things. They said, this is the best thing to do for this, but just to understand the whys, right? So if there was something that didn't make sense to me, that gave me an avenue to go learn something new.
And it's Peak. That's the name of the book?
Yep, Peak.
Okay. Best social follow strength and conditioning. Someone that posts something, you get excited. Like, hey, this is something I look forward to.
I think a lot of what, like when I was young and growing up, and I guess not growing up, but getting into the industry was Vernon Griffith, I think is his name. Yeah,
we stole every hip mobility movement he does. We just steal it and use it.
Yep. One of the things I think is unique to my training is I put a lot of emphasis on pre-work mobility and then intra-work mobility, meaning during the workout, maybe between their sets of power clean, if it's a day that we have squat, they're doing hip mobility, right? If we can increase the quality of their training or just the quality of their movement, it's probably going to lead to some domino effect of getting stronger in the weight room, more confident, or just being better at practice in terms of their strength. That transitions to better performances as well. So that's like the start of my dominoes of like, how can the weight room affect everything? And it starts with the mobility and movement quality. So that's a huge thing for me.
Yeah. And he's by no means a gatekeeper. He throws out everything that he does, and it's all good stuff. A podcast you listen to besides obviously strength and conditioning, Intern Chit Chat podcast. Is there another one that you listen to that you enjoy?
Yeah, there's two. So there's one that I actually, you know, I started at the University of Kentucky with the director there. That's the 1-2 Kentucky Blue podcast. They are at, I think, 101 or 102 episodes. And a lot of the, you know, I'd say the first 50 episodes are really, really good. There's sport coaches, different practitioners from around the SEC. There's one where we got our softball, volleyball, baseball athletic trainer that were on staff there, and they just talked about the shoulder, and our baseball strength coach as well, right? They just talked about the shoulder for I think 2 hours, and just what the approach that they take, what are the special considerations. There's, you know, we had our nutritionist come in as well. So there's a lot of episodes of just people and sharing their experience or what's their approach to their realm that I think is a very rare and unique look at how the University of Kentucky does things, but how schools in the SEC get things done as well. And then I always plug this one every morning on my way into work. I listen to the best one yet. It's a business kind of pop podcast. It's like three stories about, you know, finance, business, something like that. It's a little entertaining more than anything, but it's like 25 minutes and I get kind of the news headlines of what's going on, what stocks are up and down, what's going on business politically. And it's just very informative, very efficient. So, and very non-biased as well, which I think is huge.
Yeah. Last one, recommendation for a possible future guest with us. Who's someone we can learn from and would be willing to talk with us?
Yeah, I think if you can get Coach Ryan DeVrent on the podcast, that is the assistant director of strength conditioning at the University of Kentucky. He works with softball and gymnastics. Him or Coach Spurlock, who's the director of strength there, my career would not be the same without those two. They've been doing it a long time. They head off the very robust internship at the University of Kentucky in terms of their summer internship, which then evolves into the year-long academic internship, or even in my case, the 3 to 4 year-long GA kind of approach. They are the best. They are very good at what they do and helping people not only be better coaches, but just better individuals. And so either of those two, if you can get them on, I think it would be a really, really good episode for not only the people in the room, but also any listeners that are looking to get more out of strength and conditioning. So,
man, all right. I'll reach out to them for sure. Coach, appreciate your time. Very valuable insight. And obviously, man, 28, I was wondering, I'm like, man, this guy has been on a rocket, man. Look at this is amazing. And extremely humble at the same time. And I appreciate your time. We all do. And then I hope indoor and outdoor goes great. And pick Suey.
Yeah, we'll pick Suey. Thank you. Thank you guys so much.